From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, where we gather the highlights from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. This episode, the explosion of a synthetic drug known as bath salts.
He came in with hallucinations. He kept seeing things on the wall.
How doctors, scientists, and law enforcement are struggling to deal with a dangerous trend. And 40 years after Watergate, was it really All the President's Men?
When you open your copy of All the President's Men, they list the cast of characters. And 51 of 52 of them are men.
The pivotal role the women of Watergate played. Then in Ben Fountain's debut novel, he explores the difficulty of being called a hero in a war zone.
It's very strange being honored for the worst day of your life.
And every Star Wars fan's dream, to save Tatooine.
We had to make the Lars homestead look worse before we could make it look better.
Plus Elizabeth Banks on the movie that changed her life.
What's so great about it is every character jumps off the screen.
And later, legendary R&B singer Bobby Womack.
My doctor told me, say, you know what? I've never seen a person as sick as you.
His comeback album, The Bravest Man in the Universe. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. A little over 2 years ago, Dr. Corey Hebert was manning the ER at Tulane University Medical Center in Louisiana when a patient was rushed through the door.
This guy, he was 24 years old, extremely agitated. He came in with hallucinations. He kept seeing things on the wall.
Dr. Hebert figured drugs, probably PCP or a stimulant. But then a few minutes later,
he was very paranoid, but he started doing some self-mutilating actions, meaning that he was pulling out his eyebrows and pulling out his eyelashes.
Hebert thought marijuana, methamphetamine, but then
it would go in and out of lucidity. So it was an odd thing because he had every different type of drug toxicity, but nothing that we could pinpoint directly.
His drug scan showed up clean. Hebert called in his colleagues.
It's very rare to see five doctors in a room puzzled.
Then one of the 24-year-old's friends stepped forward
and said, you know, he bought this stuff and we bought it at this head shop. It was some kind of thing called Vanilla Sky. He snorted it and he's just not been the same. He's not been the same for 12 hours. And that's when we got very nervous. 12 hours of a high and you don't know really what it was that you snorted. That's a scary, scary thing. And that's when we knew this was going to be a problem.
In the months that followed, Dr. Hebert's emergency room became ground zero for a new kind of drug called bath salts, and emergency rooms nationwide quickly followed suit. That's our cover story today, the emergence of synthetic drugs made in labs, produced in vats, sold in gas stations, designed specifically to skirt the nation's drug laws, often with deadly results. Bath salts have nothing to do with what you would actually put in a bath. And they're not one drug. It's a family of compounds, hard to detect and easy to alter to stay ahead of law enforcement. 2 years ago, poison control centers had 304 calls for bath salts. Nearly a third of them were from Louisiana. Last year, there were more than 6,000 calls. Inside a little-known lab in Northern Virginia, scientists with the Drug Enforcement Agency are on the front lines of a new war. This is not like the drugs of the past 40 years. Take cocaine, made from a plant.
So the leaves that are there in that first picture have been harvested.
Jill Head is a senior forensic chemist here, and she's standing in front of a wall of photos in the hallway.
So they pick them from the fields and from the plants. And then in that next picture, the leaf was ground up.
There's a guy standing in the pile with a weed eater. The next photo shows him pouring gasoline on the pile.
Something that can extract out or pull out those cocaine alkaloids and pull the cocaine out of the leaf.
Get rid of the gasoline.
And so they have to then press out all of those solvents and dry the brick.
Like squeeze it.
That's exactly what they're doing. So they're squeezing it to get rid of all that solvent so that we get dry powder as a finished product.
And then they wrap it up and it's ready to be shipped.
Correct.
A natural process. But walk into the labs of the DEA where scientists are trying to figure out what bath salts are made out of, and it's an entirely different process. Instead of weed eaters and leaf piles in the jungle, there are beakers and burners in industrial labs, and usually advanced degrees in chemistry. Chemists who know how to move a single molecule to alter a drug.
That's how it's different from cocaine.
Again, scientist Jill Head.
Because cocaine is cocaine all the time. It's always illegal. But these products are continuously changing to skirt the law. So what we see this week can be very different from what we're going to see a month from now.
It's a problem for police, for prosecutors, for companies that want to drug test employees, and for the DEA, which is trying to track what the drugs are and where they come from. And making matters worse, the compounds in the drugs aren't necessarily illegal. Because they keep changing, drug makers can stay one step ahead of law enforcement. Even on a rush basis, it can take months to get a compound banned as a controlled substance. The DEA has gotten 3 compounds put on the list so far, but chemists in this lab have identified more than 60 in the past 2 years. So the scientists here are doing something you might not expect from the Drug Enforcement Agency. They're making drugs.
Arthur Barrier, senior research chemist. I make drugs.
Arthur Barrier looks over the shoulder of one of his chemists making the latest bath salt.
Basically, we have a flask in there that contains the solvent and the drug. And what we're doing is we're applying a vacuum to it and a little bit of heat. And the solvent evaporates and collects over here. And then when all the solvent's gone, John will just simply have his drug in the flask there.
What do you make?
We make all these drugs that we're seeing. In order to fully identify a compound, we need what we call as a standard material, which is an authenticated drug that we know the structure of. So typically what we would do is if we would identify something in a bath salt material, we'd have to have a standard to really identify it. So we make standards here.
And the compounds are generally legal compounds.
They're not specifically controlled, yes.
They show up in gas stations, in pipe shops, mom-and-pop stores, and all over the internet as plant food, incense, hookah cleaner, bath salts. Barrier says sometimes store owners know what they're selling is really drugs, but sometimes they don't. The key for drug seekers is small packaging and the phrase, not for human consumption, which is supposed to hint at the opposite. Do those compounds have any actual use in the world?
Just to get high. There's no legitimate use for these particular compounds that we know upon.
So do you ever think about your counterparts in a lab somewhere across the world?
Yeah, all the time.
What do you think?
Well, they do a pretty good job at it. They're just doing different things.
So they're making what he does in beakers, they're making in vats.
Yes, exactly. So they're using a chemical processing facility.
Law enforcement officials believe many of those industrial facilities are in China, India, and Pakistan. Producers ship the drugs in bulk to the United States, and officials suspect the final mixing and packaging is done here. To try to bring criminal cases against suppliers, sellers, and users of what are essentially legal compounds, the DEA and prosecutors have to reach way down into the annals of the nation's drug laws. Jeff Comparin runs the DEA's lab.
There's a challenge when we, as the Drug Enforcement Administration, try to enforce the nation's drug laws, Title 21 United States Code. If it's not specifically listed in that code, it can be classified as legal, not unlawful. But because of the nature of the structure, the way these chemicals are designed, the Controlled Substances Act also has a clause called the analog part, where we can try these chemicals as if they were a controlled substance.
In other words, the analog part, it means they can show the user or supplier intended to ingest or sell a legal product as a drug, usually with circumstantial evidence, which is difficult for prosecutors. Have you been able to bring any cases yet successfully using this analog law?
Yes, the agency has successfully prosecuted some analog cases.
How do you differentiate someone who is making plant food that is meant to be used as a drug and somebody who's making plant food?
Wow. Well, I think the catchy marketing terms like plant food or electronics cleaner, that's all code. And the fact that they say not for human consumption, they don't really mean that. It's vastly different from the plant food you can buy at a garden store.
In terms of like fighting the war on drugs, is this the future? Is this where we're headed?
We're certainly in the midst of this trend right now. I don't know how long it'll last. Who's to say, you know, what effect the ultimate control of these chemicals will have on their continued manufacture and importation and trafficking in the U.S. But as you can see right now, we just detect the new compounds and address the threat as best we can.
It seems like the fight against illegal drugs has been the same for 40, 50 years, really, since the 1960s. And all of a sudden now, it's synthetic drugs, which is totally different for you guys.
It was relatively quiet, like you mentioned, for a long time, with just the standard heroin, cocaine, meth, and marijuana problems. You know, occasional LSD breakout every now and then. But this is new and developing for us. We seem to be in the midst of this synthetic trend, and it's hard to say how long it will last, but you can certainly recognize the impact just by the sheer number of increase in poison control calls that come in. You know, somebody's ingested something and they're reacting badly. Hospital room reporting, emergency departments, those calls are up.
Do you think that there could be a time when it becomes difficult to make drugs illegal? If this trend continues where the compounds change so fast that there's just no way to make them illegal anymore?
That's hard to say. You would think that there would be an end point to discovery of, you know, the sheer number of compounds that would be active on the human body that somebody would want to abuse to feel different, to alter their state. So you would think there would be an end point somewhere. And if that's the case, we could identify and control those substances.
What if you can't find that end point?
Hire more guys like Arthur until we get there.
But even chemist Arthur Barrier is frustrated by how quickly the drug is constantly changing.
Basically, we're playing whack-a-mole. You know, they make one drug or one compound, and we smack it down, and then the next week something else pops up, and we smack that one down, and then the third week something else pops up.
Just this week, Congress moved to ban more of the compounds this lab has identified. In the meantime, officials are hoping users will catch on that if even the scientists in the nation's drug lab can't keep up with what drug manufacturers are making, users shouldn't be so sure what they're getting either. A story now about women overlooked by history. This month marks the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, dramatized in the 1976 movie All the President's Men.
Woodward.
Yeah.
There's been a break-in at
Democratic headquarters. There's been an arrest.
Local Democratic headquarters.
They were bugging the place.
The movie was based on the work of Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, the Washington Post reporters who uncovered the scandal that ultimately led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. But as Kate Daly, a reporter for the BBC, wrote in a recent article, it wasn't All the President's Men.
When you open your copy of All the President's Men, they list the cast of characters, and 51 of 52 of them are men. And it makes sense. They're these high-ranking government officials. They're big-time editors at the Washington Post. But when you read the book, you see that a lot of the sources, a lot of the players were women, and they were ones who helped make the story possible.
Kate Daly spoke to many of those women. Perhaps the most important was Judy Hoback.
I worked for the Watergate in the early 70s as a bookkeeper for the Finance Committee to reelect the president.
So you go down in history as the bookkeeper.
I do.
In the book and in the movie, Judy Hoback, now Judy Miller, was the subject of two critical scenes. One is when Woodward and Bernstein show up together to confirm some information they've pieced together. But the first is a moment both reporters called a turning point. Do you remember the night when Carl Bernstein knocked on your door?
Yes, I do.
Hi, I'm Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post.
I was pretty nervous and scared, and he said his name, and I sort of was getting ready to shut the door, and he sort of put his foot in the door and said, no, please don't.
I can understand you're being afraid. There's a lot of people up at the committee just like you who wanted to tell the truth, but some people wouldn't listen.
Knew I wanted to say something, but was afraid to say anything, especially to reporters. But I felt frustrated that I didn't think the truth was coming out.
Yeah, in the movie they show him, your sister, really just being quite the host, inviting him for coffee and cigarettes.
Can I get you some coffee or something?
Yeah, thanks very much.
You saying no, like...
Can I just sit down for a second?
Sure, you can sit down, but I'm not going to tell you anything.
Is that what was going on?
It was pretty much, especially at the beginning, she was anxious for me to stay there and talk to him, and it is a true story as it goes in the movie with him.
I don't want you to feel you're in a position where you have to disclose names.
So what was the trick with the initials?
I can just ask you initials.
In the movie, you give him only initials.
Was there an M?
You know, later on, they claim that they know who you're talking about to see how you reacted.
Who is P? P we know is Porter. You said 25 grand. Is that how much Porter got?
Is that what happened?
Pretty much, because I was afraid to say the names. Then we got into this little game back and forth of initials.
Who told you about Porter?
They knew who I was talking about when I would give the initials, but that's basically how it did happen.
Those initials would become a crucial step as Woodward and Bernstein followed the money and published reporting that ultimately shattered Nixon's presidency.
Because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require.
Judy Hoback stayed out of the limelight for years after Nixon resigned. She was never named in Woodward and Bernstein's reporting.
I didn't realize this was going to be probably the biggest thing in their life at the time, and I'm sure they didn't know that either. But I had an email or so a few years ago from Bob Woodward. He sent me a copy of his book on Who is Deep Throat, and he just wrote a nice note to me at the time saying that I really had helped them so very much, and he thanked me.
And she, like a lot of the women that I talked to, said, you know, at the time, I didn't think I was taking place in a big historical event.
Again, that's BBC's Kate Daly, whose story detailed the role of women in the Watergate investigation, like Judy Hoback. And there was Washington Post reporter Marilyn Berger, who got a key tip. Martha Mitchell, the campaign worker, whose early warnings were ignored. And there was Debbie Sloan, the wife of Treasurer Hugh Sloan.
The idea that she was this moral backbone and that he wouldn't have done the right thing without her, she thinks is a disservice to Hugh and a misportrayal of how their marriage really worked.
And she's the one who was standing at the door when they arrived, and she said, "This is an honest house."
That's right.
Woodward and Bernstein. Did she really say that?
She said that, and when I talked to her last month, she said, "I can't believe I said that." She said that's something that someone who's so young and so naive says when they're dealing with the press, because she was young and she was naive, but she told me they would knock at her door from dawn till dusk, and if she would turn the light on in the kitchen to make dinner, they'd see the door and they'd knock on it.
Do you think that women have gotten short shrift in the history of Watergate?
I think that in any story, even when it looks like it's only involving men, there are always going to be women. There are always wives. There are always mothers. There are always what one Nixon historian called minor people, you know, secretaries, administrators, bookkeepers working behind the scenes. I don't think the story of Watergate is primarily a story of women. It's called All the President's Men for a reason. But I think that it's important to recognize that in 1972, there were women in the political climate, there were women in the workforce, and that women played a role in this big part of history.
You can check out all the women of Watergate and Kate Daly's story on our website, npr.org. Billy Lynn is a 19-year-old college dropout living in the small Texas town where he grew up. After committing a crime, he trashes the car of his sister's boyfriend. He's given two choices, face jail time or enlist in the Army. So Billy Lynn chooses the Army and joins the men of Bravo Company in Iraq and becomes an unlikely hero.
So these are Billy's thoughts while he makes small talk about the war. He tries to keep it low-key, but people steer the conversation toward drama and passion. They just assume if you're a Bravo, you're here to talk about the war because, well, if Barry Bonds were here, they'd talk about baseball. Don't you think? Wouldn't you agree? You have to admit. Here at home, the war is a problem to be solved with correct thinking and proper resource allocation. While the drama and passion arise from the terrorist goal of taking over the world, our way of life, our values, our Christian values, Billy can feel his head emptying out.
That's Ben Fountain reading an excerpt from his debut novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. The novel takes place during the early years of the Iraq War and centers around the title character, Billy Lynn, and what happens to him while he's serving overseas.
4 months into Billy's deployment in Iraq, his squad was involved in a firefight at a place called Al-Ansakar. And Billy's mentor and best friend in the squad, Sergeant Bream, otherwise known as Shroom, was killed. And Billy was awarded the Silver Star for heroism in that engagement.
Does Billy Lynn like being a hero?
Billy feels weird about it. And I think at one point in the book, he says something to the effect of, it's very strange being honored for the worst day of your life. And I took that quote directly from a Medal of Honor winner in these most recent wars. But I felt like that probably pretty much sums it up. I mean, you're very conflicted about being, you know, honored and being considered a hero.
Hmm. Most of this book takes place in Dallas, in Texas Stadium, where the Dallas Cowboys used to play on Thanksgiving Day. And you've got essentially the entire book taking place in one day, in one place. You know, in today's plot standards, not a whole lot is happening. The stadium isn't blowing up or something like that. But at the same time, it's compelling. How did you figure out how to make that happen from a plot standpoint?
Well, I didn't want any gimmicks. I didn't want any tricks. I didn't want there to be some mystery or big secret that was driving the narrative. And, you know, there were various possibilities bouncing around. I could have had extended flashbacks to Iraq, or we could have followed the soldiers, you know, from the United States back to Iraq. And in the end, I felt like if it's working correctly, I think I can do everything I want to do and maybe find out the things I want to find out just by concentrating on this one day.
Hmm. The writing in this book is so visual. I mean, it's almost cinematic. In one minute, we're with Billy in Dallas, and the next minute, we're with his sister, Catherine, and we're just overhearing their conversations, and language just seems to play such a big role in this book. Even on some of the pages, you have the words that just trickle down the page like a waterfall. What is the role of language in this book?
That's a great question. And when the initial impulse for the book came to me, it came to me with the notion of it needed to sound a certain way. There's got to be a certain kind of rhythm or speed to it. And it seemed, you know, from the very start, the correct rhythm, the correct sound for this book was going to be a headlong, you know, reckless, full bore kind of rhythm to it. And I wanted to try to capture the intense experience that Billy and the other Bravos are having. I mean, this very vivid, almost overwhelming sensory experience. I wanted to try to capture that in the language, not just the images that the language is evoking, but in the sound of the language itself. I didn't want to give the reader a rest.
You write with such derision in the book about the movie contract that the heroes of Bravo Company are either going to get or not going to get, and what's going to happen with that. And here you are with a movie contract for your book.
And, you know, my happiness would be complete if we actually could get Hilary Swank to play either Dom or Billy in the movie. You know,
which is the running joke throughout the whole book about whether Hilary Swank is going to play one of the men in Bravo Company.
Right. And will she play it as a guy or will she play it as a girl? I mean, Hollywood is it's kind of like in a different solar system based on my, you know, pretty cursory dealings with the movie industry. But, you know, we'll see what happens going forward.
But what would Billy Lynn think?
I think Billy has a pretty generous spirit. Billy is going to, you know, before judging the situation, he's going to step back and get all the information he can and think about it for a little while.
I'm speaking with writer Ben Fountain. His debut novel is called Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. Ben, you have a remarkable writer's story. Your big break as a writer didn't come until you were 48 years old. And that was 18 years after you first dropped your career as a lawyer to become a writer.
Right. Thanks so much for emphasizing that 18 years. You know, it took me a long time to figure out how to possibly do some decent work. And, I mean, it didn't come quickly for me, for whatever reason. Every once in a while, I'd write something that was reasonably satisfying to me, but it just took me a long time to develop. And maybe if I had, you know, gone and gotten a Master's of Fine Arts in writing or been more connected to a writing group, that would have saved me some time. But pretty much everything I learned on my own, and I made a lot of mistakes and went down a lot of false trails. And I wouldn't wish that part of my career path on anyone.
It's worked out for you, nonetheless.
Yeah, and you know, maybe all of that was necessary. And ultimately, in the end, it is what it is. And I'm glad for the little bit of success I've had to this point.
You've got a lot of buzz surrounding the novel now, and critics have praised it. Some have even compared it to Catch-22. What do you think when you hear things like that?
Well, I'm really grateful that people are reading the book and paying attention to it. You know, it's nice to be recognized for some work you've done, and especially if you think, well, maybe I got some things right in there. But, you know, ultimately, it's about the writing itself, and all the praise in the world, all the good reviews in the world, they don't help you get the words on the page when you sit back down at the desk on Monday morning. You know, it's going to be as hard as ever.
You know you're going to make a lot of people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s drop what they do and want to write their own great American novel.
Well, I'm sure editors and agents across America are shuddering, you know, at the just thinking about the wave of manuscripts they're going to get in the next 18 months. But everybody's got to decide for themselves. And if it's a powerful thing in a particular person, I think they need to pay attention to that. And I think when we don't pay attention to these powerful drives in us, it becomes very difficult to have a good life.
That's writer Ben Fountain. His debut novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, is out now. Ben, thanks so much for being here.
I really appreciate your having me, Laura.
Most of you probably remember that as a young man, Luke Skywalker could not wait to leave the Lars homestead where he grew up on Tatooine.
It just isn't fair. Oh, Biggs is right. I'm never going to get out of here.
Is there anything I might do to help?
Oh, not unless you can alter time, speed up the harvest, or teleport me off this rock.
That rock is actually the desert of Tunisia, where George Lucas filmed much of Star Wars and where he left many of his sets behind. And while Luke Skywalker may have been desperate to leave, Star Wars fans trek regularly far out into the dry salt flats to see, among others, the famous igloo of Tatooine. But in 2010, on one of those treks, a Belgian named Mark Dermoule couldn't believe what he was seeing. The Lars homestead, where Dermoule often led guided tours, was crumbling into pieces. So he did what any good Star Wars fan would do. He started a Facebook page to save Tatooine, and that is exactly what he has done. So, Mark, you've been taking people on tours to this movie landmark for more than a decade now. When did you first notice that there were problems at Luke Skywalker's home?
When we went back in 2005, that's when we saw the first deterioration. And then 5 years later, in 2010, I went back. And by then, it was a lot worse. The plaster was completely crumbling.
Mm. So Tunisia is a pretty faraway place. What made you think that you would be able to go in there and fix it?
When we went back in 2010 and saw it in such a state of disrepair, and kind of as a joke, launched a Facebook group saying, what would you think if we were going out there to save it? Again, we were overwhelmed with people saying, you should actually do this. How can I help you? The budget was the easy part, actually. The hard part was negotiating with the Tunisian government, because as you probably are aware, there was the Arabic Spring that erupted in December 2010, and all of a sudden there's no government in Tunisia to negotiate with. In October 2011, a new regime in Tunisia is installed, and luckily they immediately approve the plan and tell us the permits are in order, you can come over and do this.
How do the Tunisians feel about this landmark? I mean, do they understand Americans' obsession with Star Wars and Luke Skywalker?
They are starting to. When I went out there in 2000 and 2003, they were flabbergasted. They did not know what we were doing, going to these locations that were used in the movie. But now they begin to understand. They also see an increased tourism for the Mos Espa set, the big one that you see in episode one. And that is already being maintained by the Tunisian government.
How did you become such a Star Wars fan?
When Star Wars opened here in Belgium, I was a 7-year-old kid. So like every kid my age, when that huge Star Destroyer starts crawling over the silver screen in the opening sequence, I was blown away. I was hooked. And it's never left me.
Mark Dumoul is a Star Wars fan and saved Luke Skywalker's home in Tunisia. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
All summer long, we're asking actors, writers, and directors about the movies that they never get tired of watching, including this one from one of the stars of the film People Like Us.
I'm Elizabeth Banks. I'm an actress. The movie I've seen a million times and can't get enough of is Pulp Fiction, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. It stars John Travolta, Sam Jackson, and a bevy of other amazing people, including Bruce Willis.
We got into this thing with the best intentions, really.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Pulp Fiction is a series of vignettes that tell multiple interacting stories in a completely non-linear fashion.
What's the matter? Oh, you were finished.
That involve mobsters and drugs.
What country you from?
What?
What ain't no country I ever heard of? They speak English and what?
And what's so great about it is every character jumps off the screen.
I heard you did a pilot.
It was a show about a team of female secret agents called Fox Force 5.
What?
Fox Force 5. Fox, as in we're a bunch of foxy chicks. Force, as in we're a force to be reckoned with. And 5, as in there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us.
One of my favorite moments in the movie involves a really small character played by Eric Stoltz.
Hello.
Lance! Vincent!
He's talking to John Travolta, who's on the phone, and bringing Uma Thurman to his house.
Whoa, hold your horses, man. What's the problem?
To be shot in the chest with adrenaline after she's OD'd. And he says, are you calling me from a cell phone?
Are you talking to me on a cellular phone?
And then says, I don't know you. I don't know you.
I don't know you. Who is this? Don't come here. I'm hanging up the phone. Prank caller. Prank caller.
And slams the phone down. And I don't know why, but it's such an honest moment to me that Eric Stoltz delivers. I just love that moment in the movie. Quentin has such a specific voice in the movie, and the language that he uses is incredible and completely melodic. And as an actor, that's the kind of language that we all want to speak. I mean, it's almost Shakespearean.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brother.
Sam Jackson has some of the greatest lines.
And you will know my name is the Lord.
Ezekiel, you know, I mean, come on.
When I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Those kind of details that Quentin finds in things. Royale with cheese.
You know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
I mean, they got the metric system. They wouldn't know what a quarter pounder is.
And what do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Well, Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac.
That's something that's just been introduced into the lexicon.
What do they call a Whopper?
I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King.
Pulp Fiction, I really feel like, you know, it was like the mark of a brand new filmmaker and someone that was going to be important, and I think continues to be important. You know, he just inspired me.
Now, whether or not what we experienced was an according to Hoyle miracle is insignificant. But what is significant is I felt the touch of God. God got involved.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished him well.
That's actress Elizabeth Banks talking about the movie that she could watch a million times, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. Her new film, People Like Us, opened in theaters this weekend. Why music matters. Every now and then we'll bring you the stories of music fans in their own words about how songs or bands have changed their lives. Today's story features an athlete from the other Olympics.
You can't lose your cool, you can't lose your focus. There is no brakes, there is no eject button. You have to finish the run. My name's Christian Nickum. I'm on the U.S. luge team. I always compare it to being a high wire tightrope walking act, except you're doing it on your back going 90 miles per hour. I was 15 years old in Berchtesgaden, Germany. It's the oldest artificial luge track in the world, and it's also the most difficult. There's four really tight turns, and each one does basically a 180. You have to steer up the curve, and then you steer out. We go inverted at that time, and then come down. My coach said that there's a rhythm that you have to catch. You have to be in the rhythm of the track. At that time, I had lots of mixtapes that I stole from my brother. I was playing in my Walkman, and one song had a powerful influence over me. The way it felt to me was just total peace and total relaxation and total focus. You know, time and space, I guess, just became balanced for me at that time. I didn't recognize what I did until I heard my other teammates that they watched the run, and they just came up to me and they go, "Oh my gosh, that was so amazing! I can't believe you did that. You came out of that curve and your head was all the way back, and you were blind. You weren't looking where you're going, but the line was perfect." And ultimately, I ended up breaking the track record and getting the fastest time ever down on this track. Honestly, I really owed it to that song, because I listened to it over and over and over again, and that song was the song that set the tone. I was born 1,000 years ago. It turned out to be the Velvet Underground song, Heroin. I remember at 15, I didn't know what heroin was. People think luge, oh, that's an adrenaline sport, you're crazy, you're an adrenaline junkie, and it's the opposite. When I'm doing luge, I have to be completely calm and completely relaxed. So I find listening to music helps me get into the rhythm and the mood that I need to be in to navigate the course.
That's Christian Nickum with Why Music Matters. Our series is produced by Anna Boyko Wyrock.
Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak.
Bobby Womack made a name for himself as a writer for the Rolling Stones, Janis Joplin, Isaac Hayes, Wilson Pickett, plenty of others. As a singer, Bobby Womack was a constant fixture on the R&B charts through the 1970s. But drug addiction and serious health problems sidelined him for the better part of two decades. When I spoke with him recently, he just finished treatment for colon cancer.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. And when I say that, I mean it. Because you don't appreciate nothing until you lose it. You don't miss your water till your well run dry.
Over the years, Bobby Womack's fought diabetes, prostate cancer, a serious bout with pneumonia. He even spent 10 days in a coma.
My doctor told me, said, "You know what? I've never seen a person as sick as you."
He said that to you?
Yeah. He said, "Everything is wrong. Man, well, hurry up and fix it, because I got a tour to do." He said, you got to be out of your mind.
Bobby Womack hadn't recorded an album of original music in 18 years. That is, until now.
The bravest man in the universe.
This is a title track to The Bravest Man in the Universe. Womack hasn't just made some retro comeback album, though. This one's produced by two of the most progressive forces in music today. Damon Albarn has written some of the biggest hits of the last two decades with his bands Blur and Gorillaz. He first collaborated with Bobby Womack on a Gorillaz track in 2009, and that's when they first considered working together on a comeback album. Albarn enlisted the help of Richard Russell, both a percussion programmer and the founder of the hugely influential XL Records.
When we talked about doing this album together, we talked about 50-50, just me and you, 50-50. So when I gets to London in the studio, there was another guy named Richard doing all the program with the drums. So I told Damon, I said, Damon, step out of here, man. I said, I thought, sure, who's that guy? So he said, that's the president of the record company. I said, you're kidding me. I said, all my life, I never seen a president of the record company come down to the studio and see what I was doing.
The bravest man.
Richard Russell says they never gave a thought to trying to recreate Womack's old sound.
We'd just get beaten by his past if we did that. You know, if you assembled the musicians and tried to make Across 110th Street, you know, that type of sound, I don't think that's not going to be as good. I wouldn't be able to do that anyway.
So he and Damon Albarn married Womack's voice and acoustic instrument with modern production elements.
He thought I was going to be hard to deal with because all these little gadgets. I say, what has that got to do with the price of beans?
What I did end up doing was using snippets of Bobby's vocal ad-libs weaved into the rhythm tracks. You know, I chopped up all these ad-libs that he'd done and laid them out on a keyboard and started playing them back over the beat. It was great.
When they would sample my voice and put it back on, I couldn't figure, who is that? He said, that's you. Now, I didn't understand that, but I didn't argue with him. I just said, okay, you guys go.
In the name of the Lord.
But it didn't take long for Bobby Womack to adapt to this new style. He told Richard Russell that he learned about the music business from singer Sam Cooke. So Russell set out to learn more about Cooke.
When I was watching YouTube, I came across an interview, and he was talking about how a singer can improve as he got older. And I thought, oh, this is very pertinent.
As a singer grows older, his conception goes a little deeper.
So I brought it in to play to Bobby. Bobby loved it. And that sample became part of the piece of music we were working on that day. And Bobby said to me, when you use the sample the second time in the song, slow it down, and then the pitch will lower and he'll sound older. And I thought, wow, he's really contributing to the production of this.
As a singer grows older, his conception goes a little deeper because he lives life and he understands what he's trying to say a little more. If a singer tries to find out what's happening in life, it gives him a better insight on telling the story of the song he's trying to sing.
You learn when your mind stays open. And once you can't learn no more, your mind must be closed. Life goes on and you keep growing, you know?
Bobby Womack says the collaboration really reached a high point on the song Jubilee.
Don't you let nobody.
When I was a kid, during those days, you couldn't use instruments. It was against the pastor's religion. So all the singers would make these instruments with their voices. It was just unbelievable. I couldn't explain it. It was called Jubilee. And the thing that Damon allowed me to do that I never had done, he said, whatever you want to do, just do it. And I said, you know what? I want to do this song called Jubilee. I'll put all these voices on.
Make me think about it. Of mine. She don't know that.
And so when I finished with it, he said, that's a masterpiece. I love it. And I said, you really think people understand? He said, man, that's educational. I never heard of Jubilee.
Bobby Womack hopes his longtime fans will join him on this new path, one he'd almost given up walking down.
We take things for granted. Because if you wake up every day, you start talking about what you're going to do next week. I said, who told you you would be here next week? If it wasn't something bad. I said, right now, I feel so fortunate to still be here and still can have something to say. And I feel that being with XL gave me that opportunity. If it
wasn't something bad. Bobby Womack's new album is called The Bravest Man in the Universe. You can hear tracks from the album and read more of Richard Russell's thoughts at our website, nprmusic.org. Special thanks to Jacob Gantz and Michael Tomsik for their help with this story. Made me work so hard to reach you. Where you coming from? For the week ending July 1st, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. Our program is directed by Walter Ray Watson. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Caitlin Dickerson, Sarah Ventry, and Beenish Ahmed. Our intern is Michael Tomsik. The technical director is Greg Gavin. Mathani Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Laura Sullivan. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.